These days I seem to be surrounded by people who've got it wrong, Reba Lafferty being one. He leaned forward, elbows on the table, holding his glass by the rim. So, let's talk about her. What's to talk about? She's fragile. It doesn't seem right to put the squeeze on her. A flicker of irritation crossed his face. Fragile, my ass. She's the one who elected to get involved with him. Turns out he's a sleazebag in more ways than one. She should have known what's going on. You're not doing this for her sake. You're doing it for yours. What difference does that make? She needs to be told, or do you disagree? What if the revelation pushes her over the edge? If she goes off the deep end, we'll handle it. His gaze shifted to a point just over my shoulder. I turned my head and caught a glimpse of a man I assumed was Vince Turner approaching to my left. Cheney slid out of the booth and the two of them shook hands. Vince Turner was a hefty man in his 40s, round-faced, balding, wearing a tan raincoat. The wire stems on his frameless glasses had been bent at an angle that left them slightly askew. He toted a brown leather school bag that in sixth grade would have labeled him as hopelessly out of it. Now the scuffed handle and the buckles on the two exterior pockets marked him as self-assured. Cheney introduced us. Turner peeled off his raincoat and tossed it across the back of the banquette before he sat down. His suit was mud brown, the jacket wrinkled across the back. His trousers had accordion pleats radiating from the crotch because he'd sat in them too long. He loosened his tie and tucked the ends in the pocket of his dress shirt, perhaps to keep them from flapping in his food. "Have you eaten?" Cheney asked. "I had a burger in the car coming up, but I could use a drink." Cheney signaled the waiter, who appeared moments later with a menu in hand. Turner waved it away. "Maker's on the rocks. A double."
"Would you like anything else?"
"That's fine. What about you, Cheney?"
"I'm good."
"By me," I said. As soon as the waiter disappeared, Turner picked up his baton of napkin-wrapped flatware, unrolled the utensils, and set a place for himself. On his right hand, he wore a heavy gold and garnet class ring, but there was no way to read the legend that encircled the stone. His face was shiny with perspiration, but his pale eyes were cold. He lined up the handles of his knife, his spoon, and two forks, then checked his watch.
"I'm not sure how much Lieutenant Phillips has told you about me. It's 1:15 now. At 2:50, I'll be on a flight from here to LAX and then on to Washington, D.C., where I meet with a group of IRS investigators and the DEA. That gives us approximately 1 hour to conduct our business, so I'll get straight to the point. You have questions or comments, feel free to raise your hand. Otherwise, I'll talk until I get to the end. Is that agreeable?"
He made another minute adjustment to the silverware. "Fine with me," I said. I found it easier to watch his hands than to look him in the eye.
"I'm 46 years old. Since 1972, I've worked in the Criminal Investigation Division of the Bureau of Internal Revenue. My first assignment was as assistant to the man who pursued the case against Braniff Airlines in the laundering of illegal corporate campaign contributions. Braniff, like American Airlines, needed the occasional government assist in those days and began to funnel money to the Nixon re-election committee by way of Maurice Stans. You remember him?"
He looked up at me long enough to see me nod.
"Having cut my teeth on Watergate, I developed an appetite for financial chicanery. I've never been blessed with a wife or children. My job is my life."
He glanced down at his jacket and removed a tiny speck of lint.
"A year ago, in May of 1986, Congress, in a rare moment of common sense, passed Public Law 99-570, the Money Laundering Control Act, which has provided us the hammer with which to pound the shit out of violators of the Bank Secrecy Act. The banking community is already feeling the effects. For a long time, banks in this country treated reporting requirements as a trivial matter, but that's changed. Many violations once considered misdemeanors have now been elevated to felony offenses with maximum prison sentences, fines, and civil penalties. Crocker National Bank has been fined $2,250,000. Bank of America was fined $4,750,000. and Texas Commerce Bank shares was fined $1,900,000. You can't imagine the satisfaction I felt forcing these guys into line. And we ain't done yet. He paused, looking up with a smile that warmed his face from within. His ice-blue eyes suddenly contained a merriment impossible to resist. I think in that moment my position shifted. I'd do what I could for Reba, but if she came up against this guy, she was in deeper shit than she knew. The waiter arrived with his maker's mark, which was the color of strong iced tea. Vince Turner sucked down half without hesitation, and then placed the glass carefully in front of him. He folded his hands and lifted his eyes to mine. "Which brings us to Mr. Beckwith. I've spent the past year assembling a comprehensive dossier on him. As I'm sure you know, his lifestyle looks clean and his social credentials are solid, largely because of his late father's standing in the community. He's considered by most to be an honest, law-abiding citizen who'd never dream of trafficking in drugs, pornography, or prostitutes. He's what we call a market-based offender. He takes the profits from these same illegal activities, disguises their origin, and introduces them back into the system as legitimate earnings. For the past 5 years, he's been rehabilitating funds for a man named Salustio Castillo, a Los Angeles jewelry wholesaler who also deals in scrap silver and gold. The business is just a cover for what he really does, which is to import cocaine from South America. Castillo bought a large property in Montebello through Mr. Beckwith's real estate firm. Mr. Beckwith brokered the deal, which is how they became acquainted. Mr. Castillo needed somewhat of Mr. Beckwith's professional reputation. His company is diverse and his financial dealings of sufficient magnitude to camouflage the funds Castillo was so eager to place. Mr. Beckwith saw the possibilities and agreed to help. At first, he employed the standard laundering techniques, structuring transactions, consolidating the deposits, and using wire transfers to move the money out of the country. By the time the money was routed through his company books and back to Castillo, the sources appeared to be legitimate. After 6 months, Mr. Beckwith got tired of paying his smurfs, or maybe he got tired of keeping track of the myriad accounts he'd opened across Santa Teresa County. He began to make big deposits, $200,000 and $300,000 at a clip, claiming these were the proceeds of commercial real estate ventures. This time he was the model of compliance, making sure all the appropriate CTRs were filed. In truth, he was counting on the fact that the IRS has to process so many millions of CTRs that his were in little or no danger of being flagged for scrutiny. Soon he was running a million a week through the system, taking 1% off the top as his service fee. Finally, deposits reached a level where the risks outweighed the benefits of doing business so close to home. Mr. Beckwith got nervous and decided to bypass the local banks and eliminate the paper trail. He acquired a Panamanian bank and an unrestricted banking license in Antigua, putting up the requisite $1 million in U.S. dollars as paid-in capital. He invested an additional $500,000 for a second international banking license in the Netherlands Antilles, which doesn't have a tax treaty with the U.S. at this point. I raised my hand. $1.5 million? Is it really worth that to him? Absolutely. With his offshore banks, he can make deposits. He can write his own references, issue letters of credit to himself. All of this protected by complete privacy and with very little interference from the host countries. He doesn't even have to be there to handle management. Keep in mind, too, when people hear you own a bank, they tend to be impressed. I said, I'll bet. Cheney caught my eye fleetingly, probably thinking, as I was, about the banks his father owned. Vince Turner paused and looked from Cheney to me. I said, "Sorry, go on." He shrugged and continued as though his commentary had been recorded in advance. By law, an American citizen is required to declare all foreign bank accounts on their yearly tax returns, but these guys aren't any more scrupulous about that than any other aspect of their business. Mr. Beckwith, under the auspices of the banks he'd bought, established an international business corporation, an IBC, in Panama, with shares being held in a Panama private interest foundation, allowing him to avoid both U.S. and Panamanian taxation. With a shell company in place, he began to move currency physically from the States to his offshore havens. You move cash, customs requires a CMIR, a currency and monetary instrument report. But Mr. Beckwith doesn't much care for filling out these pesky little government forms. No forms means no more violations, at least to his skewed way of thinking. Once deposited in his offshore banks, monies are returned to Mr. Castillo in the form of business loans with a 20-year balloon. Of course, the transport of currency generates difficulties of a different sort. Bills are not only bulky, but weigh more than you'd think. The foreign markets prefer the smaller denominations, 20s and 50s. $1 million in $20 bills tops out at over 125 pounds. Try toting that through an airport. Not a problem for our boy. The ever-resourceful Mr. Beckwith leased a Learjet, and now he flies suitcases full of cash to Panama every couple of months. Panama's currency is the U.S. dollar, so he doesn't even have to worry about the exchange rate. Between plane trips, he's been taking his wife on a series of luxury cruises, moving the cash in a steamer trunk that he keeps in his stateroom. Turner polished off his bourbon, signaling the waiter for another round. Anybody ever tell you how much money gets laundered every year worldwide? I shook my head. $1.5 trillion. That's a 1, a 5, and 11 zeros, just so you get the picture. In the U.S., the figure's somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 billion. But we're talking about revenue that's never taxed. So you see how serious it gets. Cheney spoke up. How much can you tell her about the investigation to date? Broad strokes. 4 years ago, the IRS, the DEA, the FBI, Customs, and the Justice and Treasury Departments put together a task force to investigate gold and precious metals dealers in Los Angeles, Detroit, and Miami, all of whom we suspect are laundering money for a Colombian drug cartel. So far, they've managed to place, layer, and integrate $16 million, running the cash through four businesses, using multiple accounts at 10 different banks, one of which has a branch here in town. Alan Beckwith is responsible for processing a substantial portion of that sum. Ours is painstaking work. We're still sorting out the particulars, developing as much hard evidence as we can before we make our move. The trick is not to alert him until we have all our ducks in a row. A U.S. District Court judge in Los Angeles and another in Miami have recently approved electronic surveillance. That's allowed us to monitor Mr. Beckwith's phone conversations. We've also obtained authorization to seize and remove trash from his home and business premises. Right now, we have our merry band of agents picking through his garbage. They found invoices listing fictitious addresses for non-existent businesses, assorted handwritten notes, canceled checks, discarded typewriter cartridges, and adding machine tape. Mr. Beckwith has legitimate dealings with financial institutions on a number of fronts, and he's skilled at mingling the profits from illegal activities with the mundane business he does from day to day. What he's apparently unaware of is that financial institutions are required to save signature cards, account statements, copies of checks written for any amount over $100. The banks also retain a transaction log of wire transfers so they can properly account for funds passing through the system. The information is all coded, but it's possible to use the sequence numbers to identify the source bank, the target bank, and the dates and times the money was sent on its way. We don't yet have access to these documents, but we're putting together the necessary paperwork to subpoena bank records. The waiter appeared, setting down Turner's second drink. A silence fell until he moved away from the table and out of earshot. Turner picked up his glass of bourbon. His drinking had slowed to a sipping pace, and I could see him savoring the taste. What do you want from Reba? Surely you're not asking her to waltz in and lift all the pertinent files. Not at all. In point of fact, we can't instruct her to do anything that violates the law, because we're not at liberty to do so ourselves. Even if she stole the files without our prior knowledge or approval, we couldn't even peek at them without jeopardizing our case. What we can ask for is an in-depth description of his records, the nature of the files he has, and where they're located, which will allow us to prepare financial and document search warrants. I understand you feel protective of Ms. Lafferty, but we need her cooperation.
Isn't there anybody else? What about his company comptroller?
The company comptroller's a fellow named Marty Blumberg. We've thought of him. The problem is he's so deeply implicated he might panic and run, or worse, panic and warn Mr. Beckwith. Now that she's not working for him, Reba's been removed from the line of fire, and she might be more inclined to help. Lieutenant Phillips showed you the photographs?
Well, yeah, but I'm not sure what those are going to do for you. She finds out he's in trouble. She'll fall all over herself telling him whatever you tell her.
I gathered as much. Do you have a suggestion about how to contain her reaction?
No. To me, it's like detonating a nuclear device. You risk as much destruction as you're hoping to unleash. Turner adjusted a minute irregularity in the flatware he'd aligned.
Point taken. Unfortunately, we don't have much time. Mr. Beckwith has uncanny survival instincts. We've been discreet, but from the intelligence we've gathered, he may well suspect there's something afoot. He's consolidating his funds, picking up the pace, which we find worrisome.
Reba mentioned that, but she's convinced he's doing it for her. He says once his assets are secure, he'll dump his wife and the two of them can hit the highway. Or that's what she hears. Who knows the truth of it?
There's no doubt he's preparing to make a run for it. Another week and he might succeed in placing the cash and himself beyond our reach.
Does the money belong to him or Salustio Castillo?
His, in the main. If he's smart, he'll keep his hands off Salustio's cash. Last guy who crossed Castillo turned into a concrete popsicle in a 20-gallon garbage can.
Once it was clear Vince was finished, Cheney said,
"So, who talks to Reba? You, me, or her?"
There was a silence while all three of us stared at the tabletop.
Finally, I raised my hand. "I've got a better shot at it than either one of you." "Good. Give us a couple of days. As soon as I get back from Washington, I'll set up a meeting with our FBI contact and the DOJ. Customs will want to sit in as well. As soon as we decide how we want to proceed, we'll bring you in for a briefing, probably the beginning of next week. After that, we'll hope to talk to her."
"You better make it good. I don't look forward to delivering the news."
"Don't worry about that. We'll advise you in advance."
Cheney dropped me off at my office at 2 p.m. The afternoon temperature was climbing, a complete contradiction of the morning weather report that promised a moderate 74 degrees. Vince Turner had called a taxi to ferry him to the airport so he could catch his flight. I was hoping Cheney would have the good grace to deliver me without reference to Reba Lafferty or Beck, but as I got out of the car, he held up a manila envelope.
"I had copies made for you."
"What am I supposed to do with them?"
"Whatever you like. I thought you should have a set."
"Thanks so much." I took the envelope.
"Call me if you need me."
"Trust me, I will." I waited until he'd turned the corner and the sound of his little red Mercedes had faded in the turgid afternoon air.
I let myself into the office where the air felt stuffy and dead.
I passed through the reception area to my desk. I tossed my shoulder bag on the client chair and sat down with the manila envelope. I used it to fan myself and then undid the clasp and removed the prints. The photographs were just as I remembered them, Beck and Ani emerging from various motels, he with his arm around her, the two holding hands, Ani with her head on his shoulder and her arm around his waist, the two hip to hip walking in lockstep. Poor Reba. She was in for a rude awakening. I opened my desk drawer and tossed the envelope inside. I didn't even want to think about the sorry task of breaking the news. In hopes of distracting myself, I did something I hadn't done for ages. I walked the 4 blocks from my office into downtown Santa Teresa and caught 2 movies back-to-back, watching one of them twice. I thus succeeded in dodging the heat and dodging reality at the same time. Chapter 12. When I reached my apartment, I saw that Maddie's car was gone and Henry's kitchen was dark. I wasn't sure what to make of that. The temperature was somewhere in the 80s, almost unheard of at this hour. It was still light out, and the sidewalk shimmered with accumulated heat. The air felt sluggish, with no movement to speak of, and humidity probably hovering at 95%. You'd think it would rain, but this was mid-July, and we'd be stuck with drought conditions until late November, if the weather broke for us at all. My apartment was stifling. I sat on my porch step, flapping a breeze in my face with the folded newspaper. While most Southern California properties have sprinkler systems, few have central air conditioning. I was going to have to haul a fan out of the closet and set it up in the loft before I hit the sack. Nights like this, little kids toss aside nighties and pajamas and sleep in their underpants. My Aunt Jen always swore I'd be cooler if I did a 180 turn on the bed, feet on the pillow, my head propped on the tangle of covers wadded at the foot. She was remarkably permissive, this woman who raised me, having never given birth to any children of her own. On those rare California nights when it was too hot to sleep, she'd tell me I could stay up all night even if I happened to have school the next day. We'd lie there reading our books in our respective bedrooms, the trailer so quiet I could hear her turning the pages. What I treasured was the heady sense that we were breaking the rules. I knew real parents probably wouldn't tolerate such license, but I saw it as one small compensation for my orphaned state. Inevitably, I'd drift off to sleep. Aunt Jen would tiptoe in, slip the book out of my hands, and douse the light. I'd wake later to find the room dark and the sheet laid over me. Odd, the memories that linger long after life is gone. Finally, just as the streetlights came on, I heard the telephone ring. I pulled myself to my feet and scooted into the apartment, snatching up the headset. "Hello? This is Cheney." "Well, hi. I didn't expect to hear from you. What's up?" There was sufficient noise in the background. I had to press a hand to my ear to hear what he was saying. "What? Have you had dinner yet?" I'd eaten a box of popcorn at the movies, but I didn't think that counted. I wouldn't call it that. "Good. I'll be there in 2 minutes, and we'll go out and grab a bite." "Where are you?" "Rosie's. I figured you'd be here, but I was wrong again."
Maybe I'm not as predictable as you thought."
"I doubt that. You own a sundress?"
"Well, no, but I have a skirt."
"Wear that. I'm tired of seeing you in jeans."
He hung up, and I stood there, staring at the receiver. What a weird turn of events. Dinner sounded like a date, unless he'd heard something from Vince Turner about the briefing coming up next week. And why would I have to wear a skirt to receive information like that?
I took my time going up the spiral stairs, trying to figure out what to wear aside from the skirt. I sat down on the bed, pulled off my tennis shoes, and shed my sweaty clothes. I showered and wrapped myself in a towel. When I opened my closet door, there, sure enough, was my tan poplin skirt. I removed it from the hanger and flapped the wrinkles out. I put on fresh underwear and then stepped into the skirt, noting that the hem hit me just above the knee. I crossed to the chest of drawers, where I pawed through a stack of shirts and selected a red tank top that I pulled over my head and tucked in at the waist. I put on a pair of sandals, went into the bathroom, and brushed my teeth. This was all my way of stalling while I decided how I felt. I stood at the sink and studied my reflection. Why was I compelled to stare at myself in mirrors whenever Cheney called to say he was on his way? I ran water in my hands and ruffled up my hair. Eye makeup? Nah. Lipstick? Don't think so. That would look presumptuous if this were really IRS business. I leaned closer. Well, okay, just a touch of color. No harm in that. I settled for pressed powder, a quick sweep of eyeshadow, mascara, and coral lipstick that I applied and wiped off, leaving my lips faintly pink. You see, this is the downside of relationships with men. You become a narcissist, obsessed with beauty issues that ordinarily you couldn't care less about. I turned off the light, trotted downstairs, and picked up my shoulder bag. I left a lamp burning in the living room, locked the door behind me, and went out to the street. Cheney was already there, his little red Mercedes idling at the curb. He leaned across the seat and opened the door for me. The man was a fashion plate. He'd changed his clothes again. Dark Italian loafers, sand-washed silk pants in a charcoal brown, and a white linen shirt with the sleeves rolled up. He did a quick head-to-toe appraisal. You look good. Thanks. So do you. He smiled slightly. Glad we got that settled. Me too. He turned right at the corner, heading over to Cabana Boulevard, where he took a left. With the top down, my hair was flying every which way, but at least the air was cool. I figured we were heading to the Caliente Cafe. The place is a cop hangout and all-around dive. Cigarette smoke, beer smell, the constant rattle and howl of blenders whipping ice cubes into margarita mix, tasty faux Mexican cuisine, and no discernible decor unless you count the 6 raggedy-ass Mexican straw hats nailed to the wall. When we reached the bird refuge, instead of turning left as I expected, we sailed right on under the freeway and up the other side. We were now in what was known as the Lower Village of Montebello. The 4 lanes of divided road merged and narrowed into 2, lined with elegant clothing and jewelry shops, real estate offices, and the usual assortment of businesses, including beauty salons, a tennis shop, and a high-priced art gallery. By then, it was fully dark, and most places, while closed, were awash with light. The trees were wrapped in strands of tiny Italian bulbs, trunks and branches sparkling as though with ice. We continued along the frontage road as far as St. Isidore. Cheney took a left. We passed through an area dubbed the Hedgerow District, where Pittosporum and Eugenia shrubs grew 10 to 20 feet high, shielding properties from the road. Until now, tax myself as I might, I hadn't thought of one word to say, so I'd kept my mouth shut. This didn't seem to bother Cheney, and I was hopeful he disliked small talk as much as I did. On the other hand, we couldn't spend the entire evening without speaking. That would be too strange for words, as it were. We wound along dark lanes, the little red Mercedes humming, Cheney downshifting until we reached the St. Isidore Hotel, once a rustic working ranch that dated back to the late 1800s. The St. Isidore is now an upscale resort, with luxury cottages dotted across 14 acres of flower beds, shrubs, live oaks, and orange trees. Pets were permitted. For a mere $50 per mutt, dogs were provided with doggy beds, Poyer mineral water, hand-painted personalized water bowls, and pet room service on request. I'd been here for dinner on occasion, but never as a paying guest. Cheney pulled up at the main building and got out of the car. A parking attendant stepped forward and helped me extricate myself, and then he spirited the car away. We bypassed the elegant second-floor restaurant and ducked into the Harrow and Seraph, a low-ceilinged bar located at ground level. The door stood open. Cheney stepped aside, allowing me to pass in front of him, and then he followed me in. The walls were stone, whitewashed and cool. There were fewer than 20 tables, many empty at that hour. A small bar ran along the back wall. There was a stone fireplace on the left, the hearth dark, given that it was summer. There was banquette seating on the right, with the remainder of the tables staggered across the space in between. Illumination was discreet, but not so dim that you'd need a flashlight to read the menu. Cheney steered me to an upholstered bench seat backed with pillows so plump I had to push them aside. He sat across the table, and then seemed to think better of it, got up and slid in beside me, saying, "No cop talk. I'm off duty here, and so are you. I thought you wanted to chat about Reba." "Nope. Don't want to hear a word." I was only moderately distracted by the warmth of his thigh and proximity to mine. That's the thing about wearing poplin, the way it conducts body heat. The waiter appeared, and Cheney ordered 2 vodka martinis, straight up, with extra olives on the side. As soon as the waiter left, Cheney said, "Quit worrying. We won't drink all the time. This is just to loosen our tongues." I laughed. I appreciate the reassurance. The notion did flit across my mind. I let my gaze travel briefly. Mouth, chin, shoulders. His teeth were beautiful, white and straight, always a weakness of mine. Dark hairs shaded the curve of his forearms. He studied me, his right elbow propped on the table, his chin resting in his palm. "You never answered my question." "Which one?" "At lunch. I asked you about Dietz." "Ah, well, let's see if I can be fair about this. He tends to drop out of sight. Last time I saw him was a year ago March. Where he's been since then, I have no idea. He's not big on explanations. I guess you'd call it the take-it-or-leave-it school of relationships. I've left messages on his machine, but he hasn't returned my calls. It's possible he's dumped me, but how would I know? Would it matter if he had? I don't think so. I might feel insulted, but I'd survive. I think it's rude to leave me hanging, but such is life. I thought you were nuts about the guy. I was, but I knew what he was. Which is what? An emotional drifter. The point is, I chose him anyway, so it must have suited me somehow. Now things are different. I can't go back to that. It's over and done. Which was, now that I thought about it, roughly how Cheney had described his marriage. He seemed to be considering what I'd said. "You've been married once?" I held up 2 fingers. Both ended in divorce. "What's the story on those guys?" "The first was a cop. Mickey Magruder, I heard about him. You leave him, or did he leave you?" "I was the one who pulled out. I misjudged him. I left because I thought he was guilty of something. Turns out, he wasn't. I still feel badly about that."
"Because why?"
"I didn't have a chance to tell him I was sorry before he died. I'd have liked to clear that. Husband number 2 was a musician, a pianist, very talented. Also chronically unfaithful and a pathological liar with the face of an angel. It was a blow when he left. I was 24 years old and probably should have seen it coming. Later I found out he'd always been more interested in other men than he was in me."
"So how come I don't see you around town with other guys? Have you given up on men?"
I nearly made a smart remark, but I caught myself in time. Instead, I opened my mouth and said, "I've been waiting for you, Cheney. I thought you knew that." He looked at me, waiting to see if I was making light of him. I returned his gaze, waiting to see what he'd do with the information. I couldn't imagine what would happen next. There were so many wrong moves, so many dumb things that might come out of his mouth. I was thinking, "Don't mess this up. Please, please, don't ruin it. Whatever it is. Here are 2 things I hate to have men do. Number 1, tell me I'm beautiful, which is bullshit manipulation and has nothing to do with me. Number 2, look into my eyes and talk about my trust issues, because they know I've been hurt." Here's what Cheney did. He put his arm up on the seat back and picked up a strand of hair from the top of my head. He studied it with care, his expression serious. In the split second before he spoke, I heard a muffled sound, like gas jets igniting when a match is struck. Warmth fanned up along my spine and softened all the tension in my neck. He said, "I'll give you a proper haircut. Did you know I cut hair?" I found myself staring at his mouth. "No, I didn't know that. What else do you do?" He smiled. "Dance." "Do you dance?" "Not very well." "That's all right. I can teach you. You'll improve." "I'd like that. What else?" "I work out. I box some and lift weights." "Do you cook?" "No. Do you?" "Peanut butter and pickle sandwiches." "Sandwiches don't count except for grilled cheese." I said, "Any other talents I should know about?" He ran the back of his hand down along my cheek. "I'm an especially good speller. Fifth grade, I came in second in the school spelling bee." I could feel a hum forming in my throat, the same strange mechanism that causes cats to purr. "What did you screw up on?" "Eleemosynary. It means of or for charity or alms. Should be Eleemosynary. I left out the third E. But you haven't screwed up since, so you learned." "Yes, I did. What about you? Any skills you want to talk about up front?" "I know how to read upside down. I interview some guy and he has a document on his desk. I can read every word while I'm chatting away with him." "Excellent. What else?" "You know that party game we played in elementary school? The mom brings out a tray, 25 objects covered with a towel. She lifts the towel and the kids study the items for 30 seconds before she covers them again. I can recite them back without missing one. Except sometimes the Q-tips. I tend to mess up on those. I'm not good at party games." Neither am I. Except for that. I've won all kinds of prizes. Bubbles in a jar and paddles with the ball attached that goes bang, bang, bang. The waiter brought our drinks. The connection between us faded, but the moment the waiter left, I could feel it start up again. He put his hand on my neck. I leaned toward him, tilting my head until my lips were close to his ear. "We're going to get in a lot of trouble, aren't we?" "More than you know," he murmured in response. "Know why I brought you here?" "Not a clue," I said. "The macaroni and cheese." "You're going to mother me?" "Seduce." "You're doing well so far." "You ain't seen nothing yet," he said, and smiled. He kissed me then, but only once and not for long. When I could speak again, I said, "You're a man of great restraint and self-control. I probably should have mentioned that much earlier." "I like surprises. Good ones," I said. "That's all you get with me." The waiter approached and took out his pad. We eased away from each other, both of us smiling politely as though Cheney's thigh wasn't locked against mine under the tablecloth. I hadn't taken the first sip of my drink, but I was feeling bleary-eyed, drowsy with the heat that was suffusing my limbs. I checked the other diners, but no one else seemed to notice the charged particles undulating between us. Cheney ordered a salad for each of us and told the waiter we'd share the macaroni and cheese, which was apparently served in a ramekin the size of a bread-and-butter plate. Didn't matter to me. He'd neatly shifted me off-center, away from my usual contentious and arbitrary self. I was already hooked into him. I could feel my boundaries dissolve, desire cleaving the barricade I'd erected to keep the Mongol hordes at bay. Who cared about that? Let them swarm over the walls. As soon as the waiter left, Cheney put his hand, palm up, on the table, and I laced my fingers through his. He was staring off across the room. his gaze shifting from face to face as he checked the other patrons. I sensed he'd detached himself, but I knew he'd be back. I studied his profile. The mop of curly brown hair, mine to touch if I liked. I could see the pulse beat in his throat. He turned and looked at me. His eyes moved from mine to the shape of my mouth. He leaned into me, and we kissed again. Where the first kiss had been delicate, this kiss was promissory. I nearly hummed aloud. We have to eat dinner, right? Food as foreplay. I'm starving. I'll do right by you. I know. I'm not sure how we made it through the meal. We ate a salad that was cold and crisp, pungent with vinaigrette. He fed me macaroni and cheese, hot and soft, laced with prosciutto, and then he kissed the taste of salt from my mouth. How had we arrived at this place? I thought of all the times I'd seen him, conversations we'd had. I'd never caught a real glimpse of this man, but here he was. He paid the bill. While we waited for the car, he pulled me in against him with his hands on my ass. I wanted to climb his frame, shinny up his body like a monkey up a palm. The parking attendant averted his eyes, keeping his manner disinterested as he handed me into the car. Cheney tipped him, pulled his door shut, and shifted into first. As we sailed through the dark, I rubbed a hand along his thigh. By the time we pulled into his driveway, I wasn't even sure where we were. His house, apparently. Dazed, I watched as he got out of the car on his side and came around to mine. He pulled me out of the seat and turned me until I was laid up against him, my back against his front, his lips moving along my neck. He pushed the strap of my tank top aside and kissed my shoulder, letting me feel the faintest nudge of his teeth. He said, "Let's slow down, okay? We can take as long as we want. Or do you have to be somewhere?" "No." "Good. Then why don't we go upstairs?" "Okay." I reached back and slid my fingers into his hair, gripping as I turned my face toward his. "Please tell me you're not so sure of yourself you changed the sheets before you left the house tonight." "I didn't. I wouldn't do that to you. I bought new." Chapter 13. Cheney drove me home at 5:45 through the early morning light. He'd go into the gym for his morning workout and then hit the department in time for a briefing at 7. I intended to crawl straight into bed. We'd finally untangled ourselves at dawn, just as streaks in the sky were turning from salmon to hot pink. It had taken me less than a minute to throw on my clothes, after which I'd watched him get dressed. He was more muscular than I'd imagined, his body sleek and well-defined. Good pecs, good biceps, good abs. When I'd married Mickey, I was 21 years old to his 37, a difference of 16 years. Daniel had been closer to my age, but soft, with a boyish body, slender and narrow-chested. Dietz, like Mickey, had been senior to me by 16 years. A connection I'd never made before. Something to ponder later. I hadn't devoted much thought to men's bodies, but then again I never made the acquaintance of one quite like Cheney's. He was just so beautifully built. Skin as smooth as fine leather, pulled taut over an armature of stone. On the street in front of my place, we kissed one last time before I got out of the car and watched him rumble away. With any other man, I might already be fretting about all the dumb things women worry about. Would he call? Would I see him again? Had he meant even one small portion of what he'd said? With Cheney, I didn't care. Whatever this was and whatever came next, it was all fine with me. if the entire relationship ended up encapsulated in the hours we'd just spent, well, wasn't I the lucky one for the experience? I slept until 10, skipped the run, lollygagged around the house, and finally drifted into the office shortly before noon in time to break for lunch. I was just about to unwrap my cheese and pickle sandwich when I heard someone open the outer door and slam it shut. Reba appeared in the doorway, her face suffused with rage, manila envelope in hand. "Did you take these?" I felt a spurt of fear at the sight of the envelope, given that I had its identical twin in my drawer. She leaned across my desk and slashed the air in front of my face with the corner of the envelope, shaking it so close to my eyes she could have taken one out. "Did you?" "Did I what? I don't even know what you're talking about." This was world-class lying, me at my best, rising to the challenge, unflinching in the heat of battle. She undid the clasp and snatched out the prints, which she slapped down in front of me. She leaned forward again, this time supporting her weight with both hands. "Some fucking little creep came to the house and asked to speak to me. I thought it was a parole officer doing a home visit, so I take him in the living room and sit him down to have a chat, cheery as all get out, just to show what a good little citizen I am. Next thing I know, he's handing me these and laying out a line of shit like you wouldn't believe. That's Beck, by the way, in case the light's too grainy." I picked up the black and white prints and made a display of sorting through them, trying to decide how to play this. I placed them on the desk and looked up at her. "So, he picks up some hooker. What do you expect?" "Hooker, my ass." She took one photo by the edge and pointed at the woman with such viciousness she nearly ripped the page. "Do you know who that is?" I shook my head, my heart thudding in my chest. Of course I knew. I just didn't want to admit it to her. "That's Ani, my best friend." "Ah." She made a face. "I don't give a shit if he had sex, but with her?" "Yeah, you'd think as a courtesy he could have screwed his wife instead of your best friend," I said. "Exactly. I didn't expect him to be celibate. I certainly wasn't." Ooh, what did she mean by that? With whom had she done what? In prison, the options were limited, or so one would think. "You know what pisses me off? I'm supposed to have dinner with Ani tonight. Can you picture it? I'd be chatting away, happy to be with her because I missed her so much. The whole time she'd be sitting there laughing up her ass. The friggin' bitch. She knows I'm in love with him. She knows that." Her face suddenly took on that pinched look that precedes tears. She sat down abruptly. "Oh, God, what am I going to do?" I waited for a moment, listening to the tight, squeezed-up sound of her weeping. This went on for a while, but once the sobs had subsided, I said, "Are you okay?" "No, I'm not okay. Does it look like I'm okay? I'm going out of my mind. I could have gone my whole life without this." Like a shrink, I picked up the box of tissues from the corner of my desk and pushed it over to her. She took one and blew her nose. "Oh, hell with it. I wasn't going to do this, but I really can't help myself." She opened her bag and took out a fresh pack of cigarettes. She tugged on the thin band of red, peeling away the top of the cellophane wrapper. She tore off one half of the foil and smacked the bottom of the pack on her hand to force a cigarette forward out of the tight pack. She reached for her gold Dunhill lighter and flicked it, bending to the flame with a rapt expression on her face. She inhaled, drawing smoke into her lungs like nitrous oxide, letting it out again in a soft stream. She leaned back in the chair and closed her eyes. This was like watching someone shoot up. I could see the sedative effect as the nicotine permeated her system. She opened her eyes again. "Ah, better. That's awesome. I hope you have an ashtray." "I'll flick it on the floor. The carpet's shit anyway." She was probably lightheaded, but at least the outrage had been erased and replaced by an artificial calm. She allowed herself a thin, mocking smile. "I should have known when I bought the pack I'd crack it within a day. Just don't drink." "Right. I won't. One vice at a time." She took another drag from her cigarette,
tension draining from her face. It's been a year since I smoked. Shit. And I was doing so well.
You were doing great.
I was still picking my way across what felt like a minefield, wondering if I could tell her the truth without bringing down fire on my own position. What's sick is the damn thing tastes so good, she said. The subject of Beck was beside the point, now that she had her smokes. So, now what? I asked. Beats the hell out of me. Maybe the two of us can figure it out.
Yeah, right. What's to figure? I've been had, she said.
I'm puzzled about the fellow who came to the house. I don't get that. Who was he?
She shrugged.
He said he was FBI.
Really? The FBI?
That's what he claimed, all superior and smarmy. As soon as I saw the first photo, I told him to get the hell off the property, but he wanted to sit there and spell it out for me like I was too dumb to get it. I picked up the phone and told him I'd call the cops if he wasn't out the door in 5 seconds. That shut him up.
Did he show you his ID, badge, business card, anything like that?
He flashed a badge when I first opened the door, but I didn't pay attention. Parole officers carry badges. I thought that's who he was, so I didn't bother to check his name. I mean, what's it to me? I didn't see what choice I had, so I let him in. When he pulled out the envelope, I figured he had forms to fill out, like he'd be filing some report. By the time I realized what he was up to, I was so damn mad I didn't care who he was.
What are you going to do?
I'm sure as hell canceling my dinner date. I wouldn't sit down with Ani if I had a gun to my head.
Don't you think Beck's the one you should be mad at?
You went to jail for the guy. Is this what he does in return?
I never went to jail for him. Who told you that?
What difference does it make? That's the word around town.
Well, I didn't.
Come on, Reba. You might as well come clean. I'm the only friend you have. So you're crazy in love and took the fall for him. Wouldn't be the first time. Maybe he sweet-talked you into it.
He didn't sweet-talk me into anything. I knew what I was doing.
I have a hard time believing that.
You want to argue the point? You ask me to be honest, and then you sit there and make judgments. How fucked up is that?
I raised a hand.
Right. You're right. I apologize. I didn't mean it that way.
She stared at me, assessing my sincerity. I must have looked like an honest woman because she said,
Okay.
Anyway, whatever the motivation, you're saying you didn't embezzle any money from him?
Of course not. I have money of my own, or at least I had some back then.
That being the case, how'd you end up in jail?
The discrepancy showed up on an audit, and he had to account for the missing money somehow. He thought they'd let me off easy. Suspended sentence, probation. You know, something like that.
That seems like a stretch.
You'd been in jail once before on a bad check charge. From the judge's point of view, this was simply more of the same.
Well, yeah, I guess it might have looked that way. Beck did everything he could to soften the blow. He told the DA he didn't want to file charges, but I guess it's like a case of domestic violence. Once the system gets hold of you, you don't have much choice. There's this big gap, $350,000 gone, and him without an explanation.
What happened to the money?
Nothing. He was socking it away, shifting the money to an offshore account so his wife couldn't get her hands on it. How was he supposed to know the judge would turn out to be such a hard ass? 4 years? My God, he was more shocked than I was.
Really?
I'm serious. He felt like a turd. He got in this big stinking argument with the prosecuting attorney. That went nowhere. Then he wrote to the judge, begging him to be lenient, but no such luck. He promised he'd have his attorney file an appeal.
An appeal? What are you talking about?
Beck had no standing to file an appeal. The law doesn't work that way.
Oh, well, maybe I misunderstood. It was something like that. He said it was his responsibility and he'd take the blame, but by then it was too late.
He had more to lose than I did. How I looked at it, as long as he was free, he could work on getting the rest of the money set aside. Besides, he was taking all the risks. If somebody had to pay, better me than him.
So, you came up with the idea? I said.
trying to keep the skepticism out of my voice.
Sure. I mean, I can't exactly remember who mentioned it first, but I was the one who insisted.
Reba, I don't mean to sound critical, so don't blow your stack, but it looks like he set you up. Doesn't it look like that to you? That was a stumper.
You think he'd do that?
He did this, I said, pointing to the photographs. You're the one who toughed it out down there day after day for the past 22 months. Meanwhile, Beck's up here screwing around. Doesn't that bug you?
It bugs me.
Of course it bugs me, but it's not exactly news. He's a womanizer. I've always known that about him. It doesn't mean anything. That's just the way he is. The reason I'm mad at her is she should have had more loyalty or integrity or something.
You don't even know when it started.
He could have been involved with her when the alleged embezzlement first came to light.
Thank you. That's nice. Once I get done choking her to death, I'll have her verify dates and times.
I hope that's hyperbole. Whatever that is, she said. The thing I can't figure out is what this has to do with the FBI. Why is this guy chasing around town snapping pictures of Beck? And why bring him to me? If he wanted to make trouble, why not show Tracy?
I can't help you with that, I said, mentally cursing the bumblefuck FBI agent who jumped the gun on us.
I stopped, poised on the brink. There was still time to back up. This was like standing on a 10-meter platform looking at the drop to the water below. If you're going to jump, get it over with. It doesn't get any easier the longer you wait. I felt a thin mist of anxiety settle on my skin. The feds are interested in Beck's relationship with Salustio Castillo. She studied me.
Where'd you get that?
Reba, you work for the guy. You have to be clued in.
She veered off that topic.
Did Pop put you up to this?
Don't be ridiculous. I haven't spoken to him since he hired me. Besides, he's an honorable man. He'd never stoop to sleazy photos. He's got way too much class.
She took another deep drag and blew the smoke straight up.
What's your source, then?
I have pals in law enforcement. It was one of them. And the FBI's involved?
The IRS is interested as well. Plus Customs, plus the DOJ, plus the ATF, for all I know. Lieutenant Phillips is the local liaison, if you want to talk to him.
I don't get it. Why me? What do they want?
They need help. They're putting a case together and need the inside dope. I guess the pictures were intended to get you in the mood.
He screws me over, so I turn around and screw him.
Why not?
What else have you heard?
About Beck? Nothing you don't already know. He takes the illegal profits and he runs the funds through his company to make them look legitimate. He takes a percentage off the top, and then he returns clean money to the thugs he works for. Right?
She was silent. Her gaze shifted an inch.
I said, "You had to have been in on it all along. You did the books for him, bank deposits, stuff like that, right?"
"The company comptroller handled most of it, but okay, maybe some."
"The FBI can use information if you're willing to play."
She was silent, her gaze tracking the dust motes settling through the air like fairy dust.
"I'll think about it."
I said, "While you're at it, think about this. Annie has your old job, which means she knows as much about his business as you do, except her information's current. If he's planning to disappear, who's he going to take with him? More to the point, who's he leaving behind?"
"Annie?"
"Don't think so. Not if she's in a position to blow the whistle on him."
"I'm in that position, too," she said, as though feeling competitive about her ability to squeal.
She held up the last inch of her cigarette. "I have to put this out."
"Give it to me."
I reached over and took the butt end, holding it with about as much enthusiasm as I feel for a freshly salted slug. I left the office and carried it down the hall to my tatty toilet with the permanent rust stains. I dropped it in the john and flushed. I could feel the tension between my shoulder blades. This was work, and I had no way to tell if the pitch would be effective. If nothing else, I hoped she'd give up her fantasy of what Beck was. When I returned to the office, she was standing by the window. I sat down at my desk. With the light coming in, she was almost entirely in silhouette. I picked up a pencil and made a mark on my blotter. "Where's your head at this point?" She turned and smiled at me briefly. Not as far up my butt as it was. And that was where we left it. I told her to take her time thinking about the situation before she decided what to do. Vince Turner might be in a hurry, but he was asking a lot, and one way or the other, she'd better be convinced. Once she'd agreed, he couldn't afford to have her changing her mind. I watched her through the window. She got in her car and sat there long enough to light up again, and then she took off. Once I knew she was gone, I put a call through to Cheney and laid out the sequence of events, including the hapless FBI agent who'd put the plan at risk. He said, "Shit!" That was my reaction. "Damn! And there's no name on this crud?" None, and no description of him either. I'd have pressed her for details, but I was too busy trying to act like I didn't know the whole of it in advance. "She buy it?" "I'd say so, in the main. Anyway, I thought you'd want to call Vince and let him know where we stand."
"Which is where?"
"I'm not sure. Reba needs time. This is a lot to digest."
"Doesn't sound like she was that surprised."
"I think she's always known more than she lets on. Now that it's out in the open, we'll see what she does with it."
"Makes me nervous."
"Me too. Let me know what Vince says."
"Will do. See you later."
"Okie doke," said I. Chapter 14. I closed the office at 5, locked the door behind me, and retrieved my car. I drove the long way home so I could stop at my favorite service station and fill the tank with gas. As I cruised down State Street past the heart of town, I spotted a familiar figure. It was William in a dark fedora and a dark three-piece suit, walking briskly toward Cabana Boulevard, swinging his black malacca stick. I slowed and honked, pulled over to the curb. I leaned over and rolled down the window on the passenger side. "You want a ride?" William tipped his hat.
"Thank you. I'd appreciate that."
He opened the car door and angled himself in, his long legs sticking up awkwardly in the cramped front seat. He kept his cane between his knees. "You can slide that seat back and get yourself more room. The lever's right down there," I said, pointing toward his feet.
"This is fine. It's not far."
I glanced over my left shoulder, waiting for a break in traffic before I eased into the flow. "I didn't expect to see you down here, and you're all decked out. What's the occasion?"
"I attended a visitation at Winnington Blake. Afterward, I had a cup of tea with the sole surviving family member. Lovely man."
"Oh, sorry, I didn't realize someone died. I wouldn't have sounded quite so chirpy if I'd known."
"That's all right. This was Francis Bunch, 83 years old."
"Gee, that's young."
"My thought, precisely. He was mowing his lawn Monday and blew an aneurysm in his brain. His second cousin Norbert is the only one left. At one count, there were 26 first cousins, and now everybody's gone."
"Oh, that's a tough one."
"It is. Francis was quite the fellow. U.S. Army veteran who fought in WW2. He was a retired pipe fitter and a Baptist. Preceded in death by his parents, his wife of 62 years, May was her name, 7 children, and his brother James. Norbert said Francis loved working in his yard, so he went the way he would have wanted, except perhaps not quite so soon."
I turned the corner onto Cabana Boulevard and drove the 3 blocks to Castle, where I turned right again. "How long had you known him?" William looked surprised.
"Oh, I never met the man. I read about him in the paper. With so many of his family gone, I thought someone should be there to pay their respects. Norbert was most appreciative. We had a nice, long chat."
"I thought you'd given up funerals."
"I have, in the main, but there's no harm in attending a service now and then."
I turned right onto my street, passing Rosie's. I spotted a space halfway between my apartment and the restaurant, and then did a half-assed job of parallel parking. Close enough, I thought. I shut the engine down and turned to him.
Before you go, I've been wondering about something. Did you, by any chance, call Lewis in Michigan and talk him into coming?
Oh, he didn't require much persuasion. Once I mentioned Matty's name, he was Johnny on the spot. I even had him thinking it was his idea. As I said to Rosie, this is just the ticket.
William, I can't believe you did that.
Neither can I. In a moment of inspiration, the idea popped into my head just like that. I thought, Henry's complacent. He needs an incentive, and this ought to do the trick.
I didn't say I liked the plan. I think it stinks.
He frowned, somewhat taken aback. Why do you say that? He and Lewis are jealous of one another. I'm surprised you weren't aware.
Of course I'm aware. I have to be brain dead to miss that. The problem is, Henry's reaction is just the opposite. He's not going after her, he's backing away.
Oh, he's a sly one, that Henry. Always has a little something hidden up his sleeve.
That's not what I hear. He's saying he refuses to compete. He thinks it's tacky behavior, so he's retiring from the field.
Don't be fooled by that ploy. I've seen this a dozen times or more. He and Lewis set their caps for the same fair maiden, and the jousting begins. It's actually working out even better than I'd hoped. You know, Lewis talked Matty into staying an extra day. You should have seen the look that came across Henry's face. That set him back on his heels, but he'll rally. It may take a bit of doing, but he'll prevail.
Have you talked to him?
Not since yesterday. Why?
When I came home last night, her car was gone and his place was dark.
He didn't come to Rosie's, I can assure you of that. You know Lewis invited Matty to go with him to the art museum and then lunch afterward.
William, I was sitting right there.
Then you must have seen her response. She sparked the idea, which Henry couldn't fail to notice. He probably came up with something special for the two of them last night.
I don't think so. When I talked to Henry, he was adamant. William waved the idea away.
He'll back down in the end. He'll never let Lewis get the better of him.
I hope you're right, I said dubiously.
We opened our respective car doors and got out, taking leave of each other on the street. I wanted to say more, but it seemed wiser to let the subject drop. He seemed so sure of himself. Maybe Henry would come back fighting, and William's meddling would be just the ticket, as he'd referred to it. I watched him set off toward Rosie's, whistling and twirling his cane. As I went through the gate, I picked up Henry's afternoon paper, which was still lying on the walk. I rounded the corner. Henry's back door was open. I went through a quick debate, then crossed the patio and tapped on the screen.
You there?
I'm here. Come in. The overhead light was off, and though to all intents and purposes it was still broad daylight outside, the effect was gloomy. He sat in his rocker with his usual glass of whiskey in hand. The kitchen was spotless, appliances gleaming, the counters glossy. The oven was off, and the stovetop was bereft of any pots and pans. The air smelled blank. This was so unlike him. No sign of his daily baking project, no dinner preparations underway.
I brought your paper in.
Thank you. I placed it on the kitchen table.
Mind if I join you?
Might as well. There's half a bottle of wine in the refrigerator if you're interested.
I took a wine glass from the cabinet and found the stoppered bottle of Chardonnay tucked in the refrigerator door.
I poured myself half a glass and looked over at him.
Henry hadn't moved.
Are you okay?
I'm fine.
Ah, that's good, because the kitchen looks kind of grim. I thought I'd turn on some lights.
Suit yourself.
I crossed to the wall and flipped the switch, which didn't seem to help. The light seemed as dull and as flat as Henry's demeanor. I sat down and placed my wine glass on the table.
What happened last night? I saw Maddie's car was gone and you were out. The two of you go somewhere?
She left for San Francisco. I took a walk.
What time did she leave?
I didn't pay much attention.
4:32, he said.
Pretty late start for a 6-hour drive.